Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is A Lot to Learn with Austin Rogers. For the guy who knows everything, he's still got a lot to learn. Without further ado, here's Austin.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, good night. I have no idea what time it is because this is the podcast and you listen to podcasts whenever you might listen to podcasts. Today is going to be really fun and scrumptious, hopefully, because we are at Barb's Butchery and Beacon. That is a bit full of bees. I don't know.
We keep playing on it.
I think it works. And we're here with Barb Fisher, who is a butcher, but not your normal butcher. And we're going to get into that right now. We are in Barb's Butchery, and Barb, thank you for inviting us into your abattoir, as it were.
I'm pretty flattered you asked, truthfully. I'm glad you're here.
Well, you've got a very interesting background. Mathematics professor come butcher. Where does this come from?
So I've always taught forever. My first stint out of college, actually, I have a political science degree, was where I started. And I ended up teaching with it computer-based classes and sort of ended up switching gears and going back to school when I was a little older for math and physics and ended up in a teaching position while doing it and fell in love with it, and it just sort of spiraled from there. So I had a lot of fun, and that was like the first, second career sort of a thing.
The first, second career. Right. So mathematics was your first, second career,
right?
Because first you were teaching poli-sci and computer modeling of poli-sci?
No, sorry. I taught people how to use Microsoft Word, like I had the political science degree. It was 1993, and people didn't know how to use a mouse.
Oh, wow.
I taught like grown-ups how to, like as an adult trainer, how to use a mouse, how to use Microsoft 3.0, and then Windows 95, and or 3.1 rather, and Windows 95, and like the gamut. It was.
And then you got the math degree.
And then I got into the math thing. Yeah.
And then eventually. You did this, right?
Did this.
So 10 years from now, we'll come back see what's next.
Now
we're here. So mathematics, you just instructing and whatever. It was too much.
It was honestly, I was ready for something different. I kind of burnt out teaching people how to do algebra, and I wasn't having as much fun with it as I had in the past. So. I had my second daughter, and since my life was chaotic and we were pretty crazy, my husband and I were talking about how we wanted to go forward with raising the kids and how we wanted to invest or participate financially with me changing jobs, possibly continuing to teach. It was sort of, what do you want to do and what do we feel like? So we landed on, we wanted to do something in brick and mortar on a local community level. I wanted to run a business, and I was really interested in getting properly sourced meat. And so it sort of all landed together with, hey, maybe I should consider looking into becoming a butcher. And then it just became really, it was almost serendipitous. I was a member of the CSA at Obercreek, and the farmer there introduced me to Mark Alia, who is another butcher in Highland, New York, who taught me how to cut. He's also a culinary instructor, which worked out really well. I had some connections that he knew what he was doing in terms of teaching, but I did it more as a one-on-one mentorship. So I got to do it as an adult on better timing with how things worked, having small kids and such. And so it took, from when I met Mark, within the first month, I knew I really liked this. And he repeatedly told me that I was pretty talented at it. So we just went for it. We were in Beacon and bought a building and built the shop while I was learning how to cut and make sausage. And
you're still going with the bees. Bought a building.
Right? And it was, I mean, it was 18 months from when I decided that I was going to start the store to when we actually opened the doors. So
that's,
it was
remarkable
ridiculous
turnaround. I mean, like, what's Malcolm Gladwell's 40,000, 10,000 hours or whatever to become an expert? You leapfrogged it. You're like, I'm going to learn, I'm going to do it, and then also it's going to be a business, because usually the business part comes second,
right?
And you went straight to the
I didn't know what I was getting myself into. Well, I also didn't ask anybody's permission before I started, so I didn't really have a lot of like, hey, you should consider not doing this coming my way. It was just a whole lot of let's just see what happens.
Okay, there's a couple things in there. One of them that we'll go back to is I didn't know what you got yourself into. So let's go into, well, we might spin off into the tangent of, you know, the Beacon is it's a transitionary town right now. It has peaked. We'll get into that in a little bit, but you might have some really great small business advice for the listeners. But first, there's another thing. Your mentor said you have a talent for this. How does one know that one has a talent for, and I want like granular, like when someone says, I mean, I play instruments.
Right.
And, you know.
That I have no talent for. Well,
and by the way, I am delightfully mediocre. I am adequate in every instrument I play. And the second you see someone that's good, you go, that one's really good. And then you see someone who is immense, both the person who's better than you and yourself go, oh, yeah, I can't even come close. What's the analog to butchery that you're like, yeah, that's really good? Is it finesse? Is it selection of I don't even know where to start.
I think with the conversations that Mark and I had, a lot of it was that I picked up a knife for the first time in his store that I didn't know what a boning knife was until I walked into our first meeting. And within a couple of weeks, I was able to effectively tie roasts fairly well, and I guess that's pretty hard for people to pick up in his experience from teaching. Mm-hmm. I had some pretty solid skills and just natural muscle memory with my hands and rhythmic in terms of cutting. I was able to pick up, there's a basic cut called a pullover cut that's essentially how you take out all of the gristle and stuff you don't want in the meat. You want to try to do that as tight to the silver skin as you possibly can or the connective tissue so you keep as much meat for your sales
because this
possible.
Is a business,
right.
Yep.
And I was able to get that cut in a way that I was pretty efficient at it really fast. And so between those two things, he was like, if you like this, you really, and then I was laughing and I would always joke about it as a big meat puzzle. Like I just, it to me, it was like a lot of like, it was in, like almost, it was very interesting to me to see the chunks and break them down into something that was recognizable by me as a layman at the time.
Well, like that famous picture you see of the profile of the cow, and that's the that, and that's right. The that, and that's the that, and this is the there, right?
Right.
And so you're 3D visualizing it.
There's
your mathematics.
There was definitely a bunch, yeah.
Right.
And it turns out the math I use the most is the most basic stuff in terms of like just yields and percentages and estimation. Having a number sense has been the most crucial part of all of the math training that I've had for dealing with transitioning into this. Having a decent idea of, oh, wow, this is really not the way that it's supposed to be running right now without having detailed books finished. Because when you're doing this, you're wearing so many different hats all at the same time, especially in the first year or so of a small business. So I was keeping track of all the bookkeeping while I was running the store.
Right.
And so there were some days that I was like, okay, I have to be close and guess, and I'm really comfortable with being able to round well and have a pretty good idea of what's happening.
And also be like this, with X amount of weight of this cut of meat, if I get it down to the X percentage, then I know I'm going to,
yeah.
And you can extrapolate from that.
Right.
Okay, how's meat come to a butcher? Where's it come from? And how do you get it? And like, do you just get half a cow and you start from there?
Absolutely. Yeah, actually, that's exactly what I do.
You see the classic, you know, butcher shop with the half a hog,
right,
or the half a shank like hanging up there. Oh, where's it come from?
So I buy everything for the store in terms of beef, pork, and lamb from Myler's Farm in Pine Plains, New York. And I buy full animals from him. So I'll buy a full steer, and he splits those in half and then puts them into quarters for me so that I can manage the size of them. I don't have a pulley system or any kind of hook system in the store, so everything we're moving, we're picking up and moving. So I buy a hog a week from him, a side of beef, and then a lamb every 2 weeks. And so it comes to me in big, huge chunks, and we bring it and basically start from the side up and break it down. Yeah.
And each meat has a different purpose and a different name, and each one, like X goes into sausage, Y goes into this, Z is what you want for your hamburger meat.
Right. And a lot of it is the excess off of it's with steer in particular. It's for me all about what can I make steak out of first? And then anything that doesn't become a steak becomes hamburger or trim. Then we make hot dogs out of that. We make all kinds of other processed stuff. We use big muscles in terms of some of the hot food that we do. We take full briskets and smoke them so I can pull a full brisket off of the steer. And instead of kneading that for grind, for instance, we just treat it and throw it in the smoker.
Right.
Sometimes we do different. It depends on the time of year. Like sometimes it's stew meat. Sometimes it's ossobuco. Sometimes it's cleaning up all of the details that I'd much rather was stew season or ossobuco season. It's a little faster for us, but.
Oh, because everyone wants the hearty stuff in the winter,
right.
But now you got to figure out what to do with that hearty stuff in the summer when people want the lean stuff to grill and stuff.
Right.
Oh.
So like in the wintertime, we cut full short ribs. In the summertime, we flanken style or Korean short rib style them so they're a quarter of an inch thick so you can grill them so that they're tender that way and they cook quickly and it's edible and awesome, in fact. So a lot of it has been kind of driven by what people have asked for. As people have figured out we can basically cut anything that they want, they've asked for different types of cuts. There's a real popular sirloin roast that is a Brazilian dish that we cut regularly now for people that call that know that we can do it. So it's just sort of evolved as the store has progressed and as the customer base has gotten more willing to be experimental with things, they ask for different stuff now.
I mean,
and it's fun.
You're working in this old world paradigm that doesn't really exist anymore, which
right.
is pretty amazing. You know, Mrs. Robinson comes in every Thursday and, you know, Gino the butcher is like, Mrs. Robinson, here's your wrapped in paper with the tied in a bow. And like, here it is. And she walks in, she goes, add it to my account and walks out wearing her hat and her dress in 1952.
Now it's Visa and Square. Same story.
Yeah. But still, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And people really have taken to it, and it's been fun for us. Lately, it's been really interesting for me. Like, I've done this, I've had enough experience cutting different things that are cutting full sides that I'm starting to experiment more with taking muscles apart and really checking textures to see what we can do with them.
Mm-hmm.
So we've taken to cutting things that aren't necessarily traditionally steak, but they cook like steak. There's fancy names we keep finding for them. I look up things and what is this called in general terms, and usually I find one, but it takes me a minute because it's not as common. But I have a couple of steaks I cut out of the chuck or the top of the neck that are lovely and taste wonderful, but I can keep the price down because it's not a traditional steak. It's very lean, it tastes like beef, it's fantastic, but it's different than a ribeye entirely. So some of it is educating people on what it is and how to cook it and then having them take the chance on it. And then once they do, they want it again and again, which is great for us.
Or conversely, they'll be like, I didn't like that one.
Right.
Show me what you got next.
Right.
And this sort of espouses, this is sort of your espousing of the nose to tail philosophy.
Right.
For those of you who don't know, Barb, explain the nose to tail philosophy.
So we're just trying to use everything we have. Like, I buy the full side, and we try to use as much of it as possible without throwing it in the garbage. So we render the fat, and we sell tallow, and we have it in the store. You can cook with it. We sometimes cook with it. Everything that you can possibly use, the bones, we make bone broth, and we honestly can't keep up with the bone broth production most of the time because people are so enthusiastically interested in buying it now. It doesn't come out of a cube. It's not bouillon. It's beef bones and water. And we just cook it we simmer it for 72 hours. There's nothing in it. There's no salt, anything. So you can season it however you'd like. It's just that awesome, jiggly, gelatinous stuff that,
right.
And we can't keep it in the store. We do the same thing with pork in terms of the lard and we make pork stock. We make a really nice thick hock stock that we make ramen kits out of now. So instead of going to the store and buying ramen, and you can't always source decent noodles, we'll give you all of the things that you need to make ramen at home. Just come pick them up and take them home, including the meat and the pork belly and all the stuff. But the pork stock is made in the store.
I mean, this is way more than being a butcher. I mean, I guess that's what nose to tail is.
A lot of it's been figuring it out. I mean,
it's more philosophical than it is.
What do people want and what can we do with it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, also maximizing your profit. Well, nothing's left on the cutting room floor.
That's it. The garbage can's the most expensive tool.
So, I love that. I've never actually heard that before.
I stole it from Mark. I have to give him credit.
Well, the garbage can's the most expensive tool. If you have to put it in, you've messed up.
Right.
Yeah. So, all right.
But this is also the driving force behind the sausage. Like, I have 60 plus recipes for sausages so people don't get bored.
Yours or others or everything?
I write them.
Oh, you do. You do every sausage.
Mark gave me four sausages.
So when I saw West African mint,
it's a take on merguez.
And of course. Yep. Okay, that makes sense.
It's all us, yeah. So I've used basis, or I've taken the basis from other books, but most of the time if I'm writing a recipe, I use 6 or 7 sources and find the common ingredients and then add to it the things that I like the flavor of, because truthfully, allspice I don't use because I don't like it. So it's not in any of our sausage.
So that's
right.
That's you know what? I'm sick of playing my number one hit, so I'm not going to play it if you're still going to come to my concert. There we go. Yeah.
So that's sort of, we just make a bunch. At some point or a couple times I've tried to put out, hey, vote for your favorite, but there's never any consensus. So we just make.
Right. Every single one of them is at 2.4%. You're like, well, that's a good thing. If everyone likes each one, there you
go.
Right.
So we make, 15 or 20 of them every week and rotate through.
All right. I want to circle back a little bit further. I don't eat a lot. In fact, I'm trying to curtail my meat consumption, and we'll get into that in a little bit because that's an ethical gray area. And I know you came from a vegetarian background, and I want to sort of discuss the ethics of eating meat in this carbon-rich environment that we're living in. But when I do eat meat, I don't know where everything comes from. So do us a quick nose to tail on where these cuts of meat, these sirloins, these ribeyes come from, starting from the neck down, I guess, right?
Sure. So the two neck steaks that we cut, one I think is called a Sierra steak traditionally. I just have called it the neck flank and the neck flat iron because that's what they look like to me.
Yep.
As you go down through the chuck roll, you can cut some chuck eye steaks.
Where's chuck? Is that the chest?
That's the chuck is from the front as it goes through. So it's sort of, think shoulder blade and then under.
Shoulder and under.
Right.
Got it.
So as you're coming through, the shoulder has the flat iron. It has the petite steak or they've been calling that one the, I lost the name. It's the Latin name for that shoulder muscle. It'll
scapula?
Come back to me. No, it's the supporting stabilizer one that's right there. It'll come. It's been, anyway, the petite steak is there, the flat iron. On the other side of the bone, there's another steak.
This is underneath.
Right. That's like one side of the bone is the flat iron, and then on the other side of the bone above it is another steak that some people call the bell iron. We've been calling it the inverse flat iron because I'm a goofy mathematician and it's on the other side of the axis. So, I just flipped it.
So now we're in the shoulders.
Right. And then you keep going.
What about the chest?
You hit the ribeye.
Okay.
The ribeye comes next. The chest is more like the brisket's the front chest.
Okay.
Okay. And then as you kind of go back, you're running into short ribs in the middle. And then down at the bottom is usually trim. Sometimes you can make beef bacon from it, but that ends up really salty and really fatty. And I'd rather make beef jerky than the beef bacon. So usually we just trim that out.
Okay.
But that's
so that's the bottom of the
animal.
That's
the bottom of the rib cage, yeah.
Bottom of the rib. Okay, as the rib cage curves under. Got it.
And on the top where you'd sit on the saddle, the front of the saddle is the ribeye.
If you were to ride a cow.
Right. Right. And then the back of the back is the strip steaks. And
strip is where the rib cage ends on the back
of
the animal.
And the new bone structure starts.
Right, which with the lower spine.
Right.
Got it.
And so that's the strip steaks and the tenderloin is on the other side of that.
Okay.
Or you can cut both of them together and that's your porterhouse steak.
So porterhouse is
Has the bone in it, but it's got the strip steaks on one side and the fillets on the other.
So porterhouse has two different muscular textures.
Right, and it's awesome.
Oh.
It's a really good idea.
And then what about the hindquarters?
So then you roll from the loin into the sirloin. That comes next, and that's kind of the tip of the hip.
Tip of the hip, got
okay.
it. By the way, I'm like patting myself down.
No, it's amazing, right?
I'm like mentally butchering myself. Well, because
the meat puzzle.
Well,
we're
all mammals.
Our
bone and muscular structure is literally identical, just extrapolated through different formologies
or
morphologies. You know, we've all got the same, phalanges to carpals to a bunch of little bones to two bones to one bone, right?
Sure. Like, actually, you saying that, I really want to take a cadaver class because after doing this for this long. I would die to see
well,
it. Like,
I want to go. No, you'd open it up and you'd be like, yep, same thing.
I want to see it so much.
Well, oh my God, you know what I want to see? I want to see the
body exhibit.
The decomposition forest.
Yes.
Where they, I see an article on that.
Body, it's cool. It's nature.
I mean, it is. And
it's the sciencey stuff. I just stopped getting grossed out and started getting fascinated. Way more fun.
I just love when people are like, well, evolution. I'm like, no, literally look at it.
Right.
Literally look. Cows, horses, birds, turtles, we all have the same lots of bones, little bones, two bones, one bone. Lots of bones, little bone, two bones, one bone on all four limbs.
Right.
It's all the same, you idiots.
I'm going to alienate
my one creationist listener. Dave, you're off.
That's awesome.
Where were we? Oh, top of the hips. Top of the hips.
So then you go into the leg, and the leg has got five really major muscles that we use. The top round comes from there around the...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Corner is the knuckle, which is sort of right above the kneecap.
Uh-huh.
There are some lovely stakes tucked inside of that. That one's really cool. You should come while I'm cutting that because I think you might really appreciate the helix structure that comes out of the way that muscle ties together.
You spiral
it's
it
so
out?
Cool, yeah. Yeah, you do. It's really cool. And it's just so that you get that tension and flexion on the muscle structures and you get more support for the bigger animals. It's really cool.
Right. So, a large animal will have that structure. A smaller animal won't.
But it's thinner.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So then in that same cluster, there's the eye round, which is what we make roast beef out of. And then there's the bottom round, which we make jerky out of. And then there's the heel, which in the middle of the heel, there's another steak that's tucked in there that's called a Merlot steak. That again is, it looks
the little
like
medallion looking thing.
Yeah,
I've had those before.
It's the color of red wine.
Yes, amazing. And it's a little medallion.
So
yeah.
Ours end up being flat, but you can cut them when you cook them. Yes.
Yeah.
So I pull out as many of those different varieties of things that I can cut into a steak as possible. Off the sirloin, there's the sirloin tips or the bavette steaks that are there. Oh, the name of that stabilizer muscle, I just lost it. It was right there, and then it went away again.
You guys have Google. You can look it
up. We'll look it, right. But it's all of the little stabilizer ones are getting really popular with chefs because they're looking for different things and different ways of dealing with menu costs and the price of...
And then when you're looking at it, you see the care put into it because if you are the meat kind of connoisseur, you'd be like... Oh, they've perfectly isolated that one little cut.
Oh, I hope so. That's what we strive for.
By the intense detail that you just went into, I'm pretty sure that everyone's going to notice that. It's a giant puzzle.
Meat puzzle. Yeah.
Which is fascinating and amazing, and also something really, there's something natural about this. We've been doing this for millennia.
Right.
Anyone who says humans didn't, no, we literally evolved by eating complex proteins from meat. Shut up. It's the truth. You're an idiot. Again, we are people who made meat.
Thank you. The teres major is the muscle. Because
teres major.
Lauren just saved me. God, it's out of my head. It's been there for like 10 minutes.
The teres major. One of Barb's employees flew by, dropped us a piece of paper, and flew off again with a smug look. And she's laughing now.
And in fact, it's because of those employees and all of that nonsense that I'm still standing, truthfully. I got to give them all the credit where the credit is due. Like, this is so big and it's so perishable that there is not a lot of time to make mistakes or get backed up. there's not a lot of time to not get the job done. Like,
and
deadlines
not a lot of time
are...
to leave it right. to your... You can't do everything.
No.
So you've got to have a team below you that you're like, I trust that if I walk away for 5 minutes for something else, that's going to get done, and we're not going to leave anything in the garbage
right.
can.
Right. And truthfully, the skill set is different than anything. I'm not a restaurant, so it's challenging for people who are trained in a restaurant environment to come here and work because it's a very different sort of situation. But I need the skills that those people have. And believe me, cooking professionally is a skill that we do not give enough credit for. Flat out, like, I don't have any interest in picking up that part of this industry. If it wasn't for Lauren, I probably wouldn't have the hot food menu that we have, because I have no interest in, after watching them do it and what goes into it, we do not give these people enough credit for the things that they're capable of doing.
Oh, you mean our cooks and our line cooks, everybody
in the kitchen, yeah. the way that they make this work, and the prep cooks, to have a skill to be able to cut that many onions with speed is something that is the difference between me paying $5 or $20 to get the same job done.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, I come from an events background, and right. I've been in cater kitchens, and cater kitchens are 300 people, one meal,
yep.
repetition. And that army that just assembly line, hey, it's sort of the opposite. They're assembling. You like disassembly.
Right. You can put it back together. I'll give it to you. You take care of
you
it.
You guys get
here.
The shallots on that one and the broth in that one. You fry it in that one and you bake it in that one. You put it all together on the plate and you put a little glaze around it and sprinkle it with some parsley. You're like, no, give me the big machine and I'm going to chop it up.
Right. It's something. I like watching, and I'm thrilled that I've got the folks that can do it. And like,
maybe auto restoration should be your next one, right?
Right,
because
taking apart
engines, putting them back together. I mean, again, an engine. A mammal's a mammal.
Maybe
engine,
that's right.
Yeah.
Some kind of trade next.
Yeah,
see what happens.
Go.
That'll be fun.
You've deconstructed the entire, we worked with cow on this,
right?
But we can extrapolate that to
exact
lamb
same.
And yeah. pork and everything. And so that's sort of the thing, lamb and pork, sheep and pig. That's the whole word origin thing, you know? But we evolved from eating meat. That's what advanced humankind as a species. And now we're in this
right.
deep, dark carbon nightmare.
Right.
And I interviewed Professor Christopher Schlottman at NYU, chair of the environmental studies department, or vice chair or co-chair, whatever. I don't know. And he's like, the quickest and fastest way to reduce your carbon footprint is to stop eating meat. So I know you've got your head screwed on tight. Where do we go? What do you think?
So I picked this particular path. I'm a big fan of the small farm component of this. I like that I know my farmer. I like that I know that it's a family-run farm that's three generations in, that they're doing everything, the best practices in terms of how they're raising their grass-fed beef and how they're dealing with things. They own the slaughterhouse so that the animals that I deal with don't ever leave the property where they're raised. So to me, it's Temple Grandin is right on the money in terms of how to deal with humane practices in terms of this. And I feel like I have the best of both of the worlds in terms of the small farm and the most humane circumstances possible, because I know that there's no stress on these animals.
Right.
I'm a big fan of the small farm part. I eat more meat now than I ever have because, well, I'm a butcher.
Yeah, got
I kind of have
got it,
to.
Got it.
But,
I thought you're not supposed to get high on your own supply.
You don't, but I got to make sure that its quality is there all the time.
So do most Coke dealers.
Right? I know, it's so bad. You know what's really funny is I don't really eat pork. I don't eat the sausage that I make because I don't like it. So if I'll actually eat a bite of the sausage and not spit it out, I'll sell it. That's sort of the litmus test. But
that's interesting that you understand the product. Hey, it's not my cup of tea, but you still understand the product.
And people love it and want it. And so, but I'm really aiming for the price point that we have for the meat that's here is about the best sort of meld of the economics involved in locally sourced meat in the Hudson Valley, given the market that we're in and the cost of doing business in a brick and mortar. I found a pretty good, happy place that I'm comfortable with. And it seems to people have said the same. They're very happy. It's not too overpriced. It's not underpriced. It's the best that we can do. But the meat is definitely more expensive than any kind of big box store that you're going to go to, or any grocer for that matter. My whole business is based on the meat, and a lot of places use meat as the loss leader, where they'll lose a little money on it to sell the condiments that go with it to make up for that difference. And so since this is my only source of, you know, in and out, there isn't anything that is a loss leader here for me, short of there's nothing, truthfully. We do everything we can to try to not have any kind of waste.
Right.
The closest thing that I have to a sale is we put things on sale in the freezer at the end of the month to kind of clear it out, because my freezer's pretty small. So it just kind of anything that's left, we freeze and then we sell it at a discount at the end of the month. But there's no, to me, the economics involved in the local meat is sort of dictatorial of what you're talking about.
Yes, yeah, I was just going to, yes.
It needs to be more expensive. We need to be careful and eat a little bit more responsibly, and maybe one portion of meat instead of four is enough protein. For me, I started eating meat again because I was so protein deficient, it wasn't working, and I was sick all the time, anemic, and it was just a thing.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where I just didn't have a choice. And I tried to do that then responsibly.
Tell my sister-in-law that.
Shit,
she might listen to this.
For me, it was just like, I didn't have a choice to
feel
better,
decision.
And it was the thing. And there's other people that are in that same boat, and they've told me that. But I've also had a lot of people tell me they feel a lot better after eating this meat, because there's no saline in it. There's nothing in it. It's from the farm to my refrigerator, to my grinder, to the case. It's never frozen. I think that that's the part of it that, it's small, responsibly, good quality. You make it count.
Make it count
worth
and make it special.
Right.
Meat is, and again, not to harp on this society of humanity thing, but meat was the special occasion. The hunter came back with the good kill, and everyone would have a festival. And there's still cultures to this day where the cow is the thing that you eat on the one big festival, and the rest of the year. I think you nailed it. Okay, we're clearly not going to eliminate our meat consumption because, one, it's too good.
Right.
Two, we're selfish. Three, it's tasty. Four, some people physically need it. So I think, but we don't need as much as we need.
Right.
So I think you hit the nail on the head that if we perhaps locally do this and make meat more expensive, but more linear in its production rather than this massive industrial scale.
Like I could tell you, my store won't scale. To try to make this store bigger than it is, I would be better off doing it in two separate places and keeping it small in two spots instead of one big spot.
Which I've read you're looking into.
I am.
Yeah.
I am. I'm considering.
But that would still be, its own separate node.
Right.
You couldn't overlap. This store's ecosystem could not overlap with the other location's ecosystem to ensure the quality.
Just a little bit. It'd be nice if people didn't have to drive quite so far, but I think that it would take some of the strain off of this place and keep it manageable at the rate that it's moving now, and then it would make it easier for other people to access it and make it not so much of a drive.
Right.
But I'm not sure about the overlap. I'd have to look. Because you're saying this, and I was thinking about it. I think that on average, and this is a rough guess, I think we accommodate about 250 people a week, and that's what burns through the side of beef and a pig. And the side, and then some chicken that we go through.
One animal,
250 people.
250. Wow, that's.
So I think that that's
a lot bigger of a metric than I was thinking.
Right,
because you're also super efficient.
Right. So we use everything. People have changed up how they're doing things. They buy different types of meat. It's not always the same thing anymore. So it's been really interesting to watch. It's fabulous because things leave in ways that are lovely and predictable, and it makes it very easy for me to figure out how to grow products or how to make different things become available. Like we finally have the staff and the time to start making head cheese and some more terrine stuff. We're going to make a country pork terrine and some different things.
What's a terrine?
Like pate.
Head cheese brain,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, the head cheese is the whole head.
The whole head.
The whole head, all the cheek meat, which we make jowl bacon sometimes, and now we're going to do this. But it's the whole head involved with the meat that comes out, and then the texture of the you reduce the cooking liquid to the point of it's jello.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
Then you put in a bread loaf and go from there.
Got it.
And then she's going to make some more chicken liver pate and things that are more of the just using more of the other bits that we haven't quite gotten to yet. So that's next. Like the pig head, we've been pretty efficient, but I'd like to be more efficient. So doing the head cheese is a wonderful way. And I think there's a lot of folks that have asked for it. So I'm really hoping that it helps us get rid of that as a component of waste as we keep going. I didn't mean to get sidetracked on that, though.
None of this is sidetracking because you're hitting on all the points. You know, local sourcing, you're a small business, you're a female-owned small business, you've employed multiple people, you've kept it local, it's sustainable,
right.
But also, you know, you're still a businesswoman, so you're still looking out at the bottom line. Like, there are so many nuggets of gold in here, or what do we call the one on the heel again?
The Merlot steak.
There are so many Merlot steaks of blood.
You're amazing.
It in here.
The other thing, though, the one last bit that you'd mentioned about the being more responsible, with everybody talking about, oh, let's go back to the 50s and bring back blah, 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 we need to remember that when the structures economically were different, people spent a third of their income on food. And now we're not doing that because of the way that people have evolved in terms of their shopping. That's sort of what this does that's different, that has been the biggest shock for folks, is it's not that it's ridiculously overpriced. It's just that you've been used to paying so little for your food.
From industrially
right,
consumed.
You know, like you go to the farmer's market, you pay a little bit more for the vegetables, but, you know, you ask my children which strawberries they want, and they want the bucket that we paid more for from the farmer's market than they want from the grocery store almost every time because they know that those that are from the market are going to taste the way they expect them to. It's to me that we need to get back into the quality component of things, and then you pay for what you get, or you get what you pay for.
No, you pay for what you get, and you get what you pay
right.
for. Well, yeah, we can't deny the industrial food revolution and, like, you know, artificial nitrogenization of the land to increase yields because
right.
that is what sustains our population and had the population boom from, I think the stability of the human population should be something on the order of 1 billion at max. And then the second 1917 came around and we started figuring out how to synthesize nitrogen, boom, the population exploded. So now that we're at this population, we have to sustain it. But we also have to mitigate our carbon output. So with a foundation of the industrial agriculture
right.
superstructure, having this kind of meat consumption no longer looks as bad as the massive industrial meat consumption.
I hope so. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
But I was also, I read Susan Powder in 1991, and I've been grossed out.
Susan Powder?
The milk thing that happened, remember?
I don't think I read that.
There was a lot of gross stuff about milk in like 91, and there was a lot of gross stuff about, it's just, I was very influenced by just, to me, the lack of regard for what we were eating, that's really what drove me to stop eating meat in any, I wasn't all the way vegan. I ate eggs and I ate cheese, but milk was very gross for me. So it's hard for me to want to judge one side or the other, and it's hard for me to
right.
say, you know, this is the wrong way. I so many times we say that this is wrong, but we don't offer good solutions or good alternatives for people in the immediate. So I struggle with this issue, and it's not because of the store. Like it's across the board. Like I'm just not sure what the right.
Well, I think
I don't know. Do you know what I'm getting?
No, I think I got you on this because there was a recent study. It was like Americans should curtail their burger consumption to less than 2 burgers a week. And I go, who's eating more than 2 burgers a week? Apparently, the answer is a lot of people eat more than 2 burgers a week. And I don't know. Maybe it's if my you know liberal New York sensibilities or whatever. But like, I have maybe a burger a month, maybe a steak every 3 months, actually maybe every 6 months. Like it's an event for me. It's a thing, you know? And I think that your care and artistry. Your artistry behooves that level of specialness, and then if we leap down that rabbit hole, then maybe we're not as in dire situations as we think we are, because then you're like, this is a special occasion, this is something real, and this is something that your local barb of the world created for your consumption, so let's make an event of it. I hope so, but that's really romantic, isn't it? It's a really good goal. I mean, it is, and we definitely are going to have to do something. And it's a goal that we
and none of us are going to be comfortable with it. So yeah. it's a goal that we in a wealthy nation are able to do,
you know. But that's the leadership role that you got to take as the wealthy nation. Be like, come on, guys, let's rein it in a little bit. Wow, we just went down a...
All over the place.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Barb, this has been absolutely spectacular. Can you share for everyone your Instagram and everything so they could come by here if they're in the Hudson Valley?
So the Instagram is Barb's Butchery. The Facebook page is the same. Fortunately, there are not a lot of Barb's Butcheries out there, so it was really easy to get my name on Instagram.
That's one shot, one kill. You got it? Barb's Butchery. Oh, there I am.
I know, right?
Barb's Butchery at Instagram. That's pretty good.
Definitely off of Main Street and Beacon, not on Main Street. So we are in the east end of town, as far east as you can go, with one exception.
Yeah, past Dogwood, make a left.
Right? Stay on, just keep going. You're going to go through the neighborhood. You're going to be like, really? Yeah, just keep going. It's at the top of the hill.
Yeah, it's at the top of the hill. Yeah. And then you make a really quick U-turn like I did, because I'm like, oh, there it is. Woo!
I got to turn around.
And I was told, why are you driving so spastic? I'm like, well, because it's right there. Barb, this has been absolutely fantastic. So fascinating. Mathematician, come butcher, come Instagram. Got her first one on her first try.
I did. I got lucky. I don't even have a personal Instagram.
Good.
I got to Facebook and I can't. I'm old, man. I remember in 1983 making fun of my grandmother for not being able to program the clock on the VCR. Yeah. I am so you're that person.
Yep. You hold your phone at a certain angle and you press it one at a time.
I'm like, why is it doing something different than it did before? It's terrible.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been absolutely fantastic. If you are in the neck of the woods of the Hudson Valley, please drive to Spring Street in Beacon, New York, and check out Barb's Butchery, and have a sandwich and take home some sausages. Everyone have a great night. Thank you, Barb.
Thanks.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.